Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the KirbyCast. I am your host, Mike Lane, and this is a podcast intended to celebrate the Bronze Age work of one of the greatest comic creators, possibly the greatest comic creator of all time, Jack King Kirby. Since this is the premiere episode, I want to start by letting listeners know what they can expect from this show. First and foremost, this is going to be a review show. I plan to discuss issues of his Bronze Age work, starting with his move to DC in 1970, his return to Marvel in 1976, and independent work with publishers like Pacific Comics and others throughout the 1980s. For the most part, I will be moving chronologically, with a few exceptions every now and then. And that would be stuff like his black and white magazine Spirit World and In the Days of the Mob, also his Silver Surfer graphic novel with Stan Lee, other special projects like that. These sorts of things may be taken out of publication order because they probably deserve some extra attention, and they may make for a nice change of pace every now and then. I do also want to keep the format a bit loose, meaning some episodes may only cover one issue, others two or even three. It all depends on the denseness of the story or how much I feel I have to say about them. At times, it will also be more than just a review show. I do plan to have episodes devoted to topics like the Jack Kirby Museum, particular interviews with Kirby over the years. I may also discuss books or magazine articles about Kirby and his work. These will be sprinkled throughout and may sometimes be combined with an actual comic review show. Now, something this show is not going to be is any sort of in-depth biographical study of the man's life. There are plenty of sources out there for that. I am not Mark Evanier, and I don't claim to be any sort of Jack Kirby expert. I am just a fan, and this is, as I said, intended to be a celebration of his actual work, which will be my main focus. Of course, I will occasionally provide a bit of personal information, especially if it provides some background or context for whatever work I'm covering in a certain episode. But ultimately, this show is intended as more of a personal journey through his work. As I go through his comics, I want to share my feelings, reactions, opinions about the story, the art, the characters. I also want to hear your opinions. I'd encourage listeners to please write in. Let me know what you think of the issues I'm covering. If you think something I said is completely off base, if you had a completely different reaction to an issue, write in and let me know. I'd be happy to share your thoughts on the following episode. I want to hear feedback. I want to hear different opinions. That's what makes life interesting. And frankly, also, if you write in and say, Mike, I think you are 100% correct on something, I wouldn't mind hearing that either. Now, the next thing I want to discuss is, why am I doing this? What made me decide to do an episode covering Kirby's Bronze Age work? Well, it's something I've been thinking about for a while. I've gone out of my way over the last couple years to collect most of his Bronze Age work and original issues or collections, and this being his 100th birthday, it seemed like a good way to honor his memory. For a bit of my own history involving Jack Kirby, I'm 44 years old now, and I started collecting comics around 83 or 84. So it was a time when Kirby was not on good terms with Marvel, and except for some superpowers and fourth world work for DC, he had pretty much moved on to independent comics at that point, after having taken a foray in animation for a number of years. Now, being primarily a Marvel guy in my first couple years of collecting, his new work was not even remotely on my radar at the time. Having said that, though, it did not take me long to discover who he was and what his significance was to the industry, particularly Marvel. Only about a year or two into collecting comics, I was already collecting back issues pretty heavily out of the bins, and many of my first buys were comics like The Avengers and The Fantastic Four, two titles I particularly liked. And because of my budget at that age, a lot of the comics I got were from the late 70s. These issues had quite a few Jack Kirby covers and included articles touting his return to Marvel at the time. It's hard to say precisely for sure so many years later, but I'm pretty confident that that's how I first became aware of his significance to the company. Unlike a lot of readers who first encountered his work around my age in the 80s, I never had a negative view towards his art. I've heard of many collectors who started in the 70s and 80s say that at first they were turned off by it. It took them a lot of years, well into adulthood, to finally have a click and understand why he was in such high regard. That wasn't so much the case with me. I never disliked it from the beginning. I will say I also cannot pretend to have fallen in love with it right away either. Instead, I compartmentalized it. I've always been into history, including comic history, and his work for me was something from another time. I saw it as sort of an artifact. I found it very fascinating to look at. kind of as representative of its era, although I didn't find myself at first, at least personally, excited by it like I was with current artists from the time current comics I was reading. But it would not take very long for that to change. Pretty quickly, I started seeking out Silver Age back issues as well, as soon as I could afford them. And among the first that I got was issue 57 of the Fantastic Four and the surrounding issues as well. Those comics blew my mind, particularly issue 57, which is the story involving Dr. Doom capturing the Silver Surfer and stealing the power cosmic. I love that story. It was amazing to me. I was probably around 13 years old at the time, and it hit me at just the right age. Those images of Dr. Doom, the Silver Surfer, Latveria, the energy, the pages, as always with Kirby, they literally crackled. The way he drew Dr. Doom so grotesquely evil, but still sort of conveying the sense of nobility. His Silver Surfer was this bizarre, naive, angelic figure riding a surfboard. Stan Lee's over-the-top, melodramatic dialogue was an absolute perfect fit for the story that Kirby drew. When I read these issues, Kirby was no longer just an important figure from the past. His work became as exciting to me as the artist from the current comics I was reading at the time. I started trying to hunt down as many Silver Age FF comics as a kid my age could afford. I fell in love with Kirby's Thing in particular, the way he drew Ben Grimm, the attitude that Stan Lee and him attributed to the character. Now keep in mind that when I began reading the FF in current form, She-Hulk had taken Ben's place on the team, so I knew the Thing well already from the Bronze Age back issues I had already read, but those Silver Age issues were what made Ben my favorite character in the FF for life. Even though I was a child of the 80s, these Silver Age Kirby issues, particularly that issue 57 of the FF, hit me at an age where I was young and impressionable enough that I was able to feel a similar sense of wonder as to what I think young comic readers in 1967 probably felt when they picked that issue up off the stand. From then on, Kirby was one of the greats to me, not because I was told that by an earlier generation of readers, but because it was what I felt in my heart, my instinctual reaction to his work when I saw it. Other Silver Age issues soon reinforced that feeling. I remember Tales of Suspense with Captain America by Jack Kirby being a particular standout. I think the first story I picked up there was the one in which Captain America fought the Nazi sleeper robot, and I ate that one up. And as soon as the Marvel Masterworks started coming out, I would add them to my Christmas list every year, and I got to experience the earliest adventures of the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, the X-Men. It was wonderful, and Jack Kirby was a huge part of that. Even though I began collecting DC comics about 2 years or so after picking up my first Marvel comic, it took much longer for me to go looking for DC back issues. I think it's because I was a post-crisis kid. I started collecting, you know, DC literally right after the crisis, beginning with Superman. I knew how the crisis had reshaped the DC universe, and I think it sort of began to represent something of a wall in my mind. I was interested in the current DC books, but at first did not really feel a big desire to go back and check out the past. And that included Jack Kirby's Fourth World books. At least not immediately. It did happen eventually, of course, and I'll get into that a little bit in a later episode when I get around to covering his Fourth World books. For now, I want to get back to introducing this show. I thought about how I'm going to review individual issues, and beyond describing my general feelings, I decided to go with a rating system. But I wanted it to be something that was tailored specifically to Jack Kirby. One that will speak directly to what people often view as both his strengths and his weaknesses. So I'm going to use a 1-5 scale, 5 being the best to rate each story for several different things. Of course, one thing I'm going to rate it on, which is a word, it's almost cliche to use with Kirby, but I feel like it'll give me a lot to discuss, and that is the energy, just the sense of energy as you read the story. How fast things move, how dynamic his pages are, his characters. They often look like they're going to burst right off the page, even if they're just having a casual conversation. So I felt like starting off with the energy of the story would be a good way to rate on that 1-5 scale. Secondly, people also frequently mention how many concepts Kirby would throw out there, and I'm going to use a very expansive definition of that word here, cheat a little bit. I'm going to use it to refer to new characters, to vehicles, to planets, aliens, gadgets, any new creation or idea, any mythology Kirby throws out in a single story. I want that to be the second category. So particularly that's going to be one where in these initial issues of comics like The Fourth World and The Eternals, it's almost going to be impossible for him to not get a really high score. But I do think as we go along in some of the later issues of some of the titles, particularly as they near the end, then you may have him maybe not in every title, but occasionally spinning his wheels. Those may be times where they aren't sort of bursting with all the ideas that he normally uses when he starts out on a particular title. So those are the kind of things I'm going to mean when I rate the story for concepts. This next category I'm going to rate each comic on, I had to think about for a while because it's really touching on what is a big criticism of Kirby. And specifically, it's going to be the writing. And when I say writing, I mean both the plotting and the dialogue. And dialogue is an area where, and I think it's fair to be honest, in the Kirby's Bronze Age work, he does get his most criticism. And to be honest, as I said, I think it's a fair criticism. But I also think that makes worth evaluating in each comic. And particularly when he starts out, I think that's going to be when he's receiving some of his lower scores, maybe around the Fourth World. But I think as we move along, some later comics, he's going to get a lot better at it. And I'll give you an example. Probably my favorite single work of his from the Bronze Age is the first dozen or so issues of the Eternals title before they started having to shoe in some of the mainstream Marvel Universe things, like having the Hulk robot show up, which we'll discuss in more detail later when we get to the Eternals. But I think those first dozen or so issues really represent sort of Kirby, the pinnacle of his work in that era. He uses similar concepts to what he used on the Fourth World, but I think he's gained a little more discipline in his writing. I think he's fine-tuned some of them a lot. Now, having said that, I do think the Fourth World characters are definitely my favorite creations from his Bronze Age work. But I do think it is, to be honest, more of a mixed bag with some of the actual comics from the Fourth World. Even some of the art, due, I think, primarily to inking issues in some of those earlier tales, can be a problem. But also, fortunately, the fact that they wouldn't use his Superman head, which we'll discuss in more detail again when we get to that. But the fact that they had other artists come in to maintain sort of the house look on the Superman character. But anyways, I think, again, the Fourth World are my favorite characters, but the Eternals are probably my favorite product or overall story arc. So that leaves us with energy, concepts, and writing. That leaves the next one, which is pretty obvious for a Jack Kirby comic. It's going to be art. Art seems like a no-brainer, but I want to dig into it on each issue. As I said, there's going to be some problems at times, a lot of it, as I said, due to the inking. And I think it's fair to talk about that and compare. So I want to dig into that, particularly in the early Fourth World issues. There's also coloring to view. It's not all just Kirby's pencils. As I said, we'll get into the Superman head issue and a lot of those as well. Those are things we'll really be able to dig into in rating the art, I think, as we move along. Now, I am going to discuss one comic in this episode, or at least part of a comic. And I'm talking about the Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. story in Strange Tales number 148. Yes, a S.H.I.E.L.D. story. So why am I kicking off my podcast devoted to Kirby in the Bronze Age by discussing a Silver Age issue? Well, for some background, I picked up the S.H.I.E.L.D. Omnibus a few months ago, and I'm currently in the midst of reading it. Outside of the Steranko issues, this title has been probably the last big blind spot for me among Marvel's Silver Age books. I've actually been really enjoying it so far, particularly the Kirby and John Severin drawn issues early in the run. These early S.H.I.E.L.D. stories, they've had very much emulating The Man from U.N.C.L.E., as well as James Bond 2. This story I will be covering even has a little moment of Nick Fury being shown new gadgets that's very much like the Bond scene with Q that would occur in each James Bond film. But again, why am I discussing this here? Well, when I got to this issue, number 148, I was quite surprised to see that Kirby himself had scripted it. Yes, this issue was written by Jack Kirby in 1966 for Marvel. I was unaware that he had done that at all at Marvel back then. Now, I realize he plotted every comic he worked on through his penciling or layouts, but scripting? That I was unaware of. So, since his writing in the Bronze Age is going to be such a topic of discussion as we move along, I figured it would be interesting to start by taking a look at this Silver Age issue that he scripted. This comic is cover dated September 1966. The on-sale date is June 1966. The cover to this issue is by Bill Everett. It's actually a Doctor Strange cover. They rotated at the time, but this time Doctor Strange is up, not S.H.I.E.L.D. The scripts and layouts are done by Jack Kirby. The penciling and inking is done by Don Heck, Dashing Don Heck. The lettering is by Sam Rosen, and it is edited by Stan Lee. This story opens shortly after an explosion has ripped through S.H.I.E.L.D.'s detention center. Nick Fury has been inside questioning a prisoner, and the fire crews arrive just as Nick emerges from the flames and collapses. Dum-Dum Dugan gets Nick inside a large glass tube filled with a cell-repairing substance called Vitafluid, but everyone fears that Fury's injuries are too severe for him to survive. As his friend lay dying, Dum-Dum is overcome with emotion and is swearing revenge when suddenly the real Nick Fury arrives and reveals that his injured doppelganger is actually a life model decoy, also known as an LMD. Apparently, Agent Jasper Sitwell of S.H.I.E.L.D. had suggested that Fury question their AIM prisoners by remote control through an LMD. AIM must have decided to silence the prisoners and hope to take care of Fury at the same time. The story shifts to the headquarters of AIM, short for Advanced Idea Mechanics. They are monitoring the events at S.H.I.E.L.D. and have learned that while they succeeded in killing their captured agents, they failed to kill Nick Fury. They're frustrated that it is impossible to tell the difference between a real person and an LMD, but they have a plan for stealing one. While most of those present from AIM are wearing their traditional yellow beekeeper uniforms, one of them is wearing a suit with a derby hat. We learn that he has gone undercover with the Council of Free Nations and has provoked a situation that is forcing him to call Fury before a board of inquiry. Forcing Fury to fight for his honor and job before the council will also keep him distracted while they try to capture an LMD. Meanwhile, at S.H.I.E.L.D.'s Ordnance Division, Nick is getting a demonstration of some of their latest hardware, which includes a Tri-D Roentgen handgun, not easy to say, spelled R-O-E-N-T-G-E-N, and it projects harmless 3D x-rays and can render anything transparent. Basically, it works just like an x-ray machine, but without the film. And when they use it on Nick for a demonstration, he basically looks like a walking, smoking skeleton. Why would they make this? I have no idea. But anyways, Nick returns to his office and finds Agent Sitwell, who jumps out from behind the door with a gun and shouts, "Bang, you're dead, Chief." Apparently, this is Sitwell's way of making the point that their security is too weak, and he shows Nick that he got in by burning a big hole in Nick's ceiling from the barbershop above. Needless to say, Nick is not very happy and gives Sitwell a mouthful. And in the last panel, Sitwell looks so sad that he looks like he is just about to cry. Once Sitwell leaves, Nick sees something among his mail he's been expecting, a notice to appear before a board of inquiry. Nick says it was bound to come. He stepped on enough VIP toes to fill a chiropractor's calendar for a full year. No one quite talks like Nick does. Nick's situation is big news and gets the front page treatment in the newspaper, so I guess he's certainly not a secret spy, although the location of the hearing is being kept secret from the public. While Nick arrives for the hearing, AIM attacks S.H.I.E.L.D.'s hidden airport and gasses the airfield, knocking out the guards. AIM lands, and about a dozen troops fan out in search of an LMD. Back at the hearing, AIM's undercover agent is on the witness stand, accusing Fury of, among other things, stopping his plan to develop a new space drive propellant. While claiming that he bore Fury no personal grudges, he asserts that Fury's offensive policies have deprived free nations of great new inventions just when they need them most. A follow-up witness tries to defend Fury's leadership, but manages to only make things worse when he describes him as a top-notch fighting man who looks and acts like he hasn't left his foxhole for 20 years. Meanwhile, AIM continues their assault at the S.H.I.E.L.D. airport, and they plan to use a hypnolite on one of the S.H.I.E.L.D. soldiers to make him lead them to an LMD. At the trial, a surprise witness is called, Jasper Sitwell. The AIM spy expects that Sitwell's testimony will likely seal Fury's fate, and based on how badly Fury reamed out Sitwell earlier in the issue, a reader would understandably feel very nervous for Fury right now. When asked to rate his boss, Sitwell responds that he can't think of any man he hates more. But he goes on, "I hate Nick Fury for being the kind of great leader I may never become, for setting standards so high that I may never reach them. That is laying it on thick, Jasper. Hearing this, the AIM spy begins to panic. He realizes that the fight between Fury and Sitwell was staged. They knew AIM was watching them the whole time. Fury then jumps out of his seat, takes down several guards, and leaps out the window despite them being inside a helicarrier several miles up in the air. The council is confused, wondering why Nick would jump to his death like that. But Jasper knows that Nick's belt chute would have opened automatically and that he should be safely on the ground by now. Jasper is correct, for we see Fury land and meet his ride, Dum-Dum Dugan. Dum-Dum tells him that he got word that AIM hit SHIELD earlier as they expected, only AIM doesn't know that they're about to be greeted by the head of the house. And that is the end of the issue. Okay, overall I thought this issue was okay. It's not a standout, but not bad either. These SHIELD stories, like all those characters who were sharing a book in Marvel at the time, tended to be more serialized than the comics that were devoted entirely to one hero or team. And I'm referring to the characters featured in titles like Tales of Suspense, Tales to Astonish, etc. So this story is carrying over from a long-running arc involving AIM, and it ends on something of a cliffhanger. A lot happens in the issue, but ultimately reads very much like you're hitting the middle of a story, with no real definitive conclusion. Now let's move to my rankings, starting with energy. As I said, a lot happens here, and the story does move at a very brisk pace. We start with the excitement of Fury walking out of a fire after the detention section has been blown up. Then he apparently dies, and Dum-Dum is in tears when the real Fury steps forth and reveals that it had been an LMD. A single page establishes AIM's two plans to put Nick on trial and to steal an LMD. We get the weird X-ray skeleton interlude followed by Nick tearing into Sitwell, followed by AIM's attack, Fury's trial, and it ends with Nick jumping out of the helicarrier. There's definitely a lot of energy to this story. Although the finishing pencils were by Don Heck, the layouts did make it very dynamic in presentation and helped kind of convey the urgency of everything going on. So overall, I'd rank it as probably a 3. You know, good, nothing on the grand scale of what we'd see in like the New Gods or Eternals, but still, you know, there was a lot of energy to this story, particularly for being only 12 pages long. Now, next is concepts. Now, again, we don't see anything grand here along the lines of his later Bronze Age work. There's no big, giant mythologies, nothing cosmic level or mind-blowing. We basically get a lot of gadgets and vehicles. Now, we get the glass tube with the cell-repairing Vita fluid. We get that bizarre X-ray gun that I still don't see the point of. Nick uses a communications device at one point hidden inside a pin, a very 1960s James Bond spy kind of tool there. When AIM attacks SHIELD at the airport, they're flying this very classic Kirby aircraft. It's a fantastic design. As they move through the base, they use what's called a rocket car and underground tunnels, which is basically its own subway system that SHIELD built under the base. But these aren't regular subway cars. They have that very great Kirby futuristic design to them. So while we are not seeing anything grand here, I give Kirby a lot of credit for introducing so many sort of neat, smaller scaled concepts and interesting vehicles in what is only a 12-page spy story. I think setting counts for a lot when I have to evaluate these things. And again, this is not a, you know, mythological level story being told by Kirby like I'll do later on. It's a spy comic with a small page run. And with those limitations and it being particularly a continued chapter, the shorter length, I'm going to be generous and still rank it high as a 4 for concepts. Next, I want to turn to the art. Now, this is one of only a very, very few occasions I will be ranking a comic on here in which Jack Kirby was not the primary artist. Now, I should start off up front by saying that I'm actually a Don Heck fan and defender. I really love his work on Iron Man and the Avengers in the early Silver Age comics. He draws beautiful women. And I think his only, you know, crime, unfortunately, was being basically a non-superhero artist in an industry that got taken over by superheroes. Now, having said that, I do almost feel bad that I do have some issues with the art. I think the biggest problem is inconsistency, which feels weird to say when you have a guy who did both the penciling and inking. You'd think that that would be pretty consistent throughout. But Nick's look changes a few times throughout the issue. There are some pages as well that are glorious, like the splash page of Nick walking out of the fire, or the page showing AIM attack the base. But some of the other pages, like Dum-Dum trying to save LMD Nick, or Nick and Jasper arguing, I don't know, something about the renderings of the people is off. I think a large part of it actually has to do with the inking, because some aspects of the story, some pages are just very heavily inked, others only really lightly so. So I think that definitely is in large part responsible for the inconsistency. So again, while I actually am a fan of Don Heck, I do think in this case I'm probably going to go lower with the art, and I'm probably just going to give it a 2. I really wish I could go higher, but I really just think the inking makes the story too uneven in the art. Lastly, we have the writing. This really surprised me because I went in expecting it to be much more similar to Kirby's style in the New Gods books. As I said earlier, I do think the criticism of his writing and dialogue in his Bronze Age work is fair. Characters never really tended to talk remotely like real people do, which could be fun, but I do think in those New God books, he was sometimes trying to introduce so many concepts that the writing lost focus, and he wasn't giving the characters and moments enough time to breathe. It could almost be overwhelming to read at times. Now, as I'll get to later, I think that could lead to some fun aspects to the book too, but I do think perhaps having another scripter or stronger editing might have helped those stories a lot. So I kind of expected to see that in this story, but, you know, if you handed me this issue and the credits were not included, I would have assumed Stanley or Roy Thomas wrote this. It reads very much like a 60s Marvel comic. It's got the typical melodrama associated with Stan Lee, but it's not as out of control or, you know, I'll be honest and say goofy, as I expected. Perhaps this is another area where the fact that this is a spy story and part of an ongoing story may have helped to rein in some of the more negative tendencies in his writing. Maybe he was just disciplined. At the end of the day, he knew his job. He was the fill-in scripter, and he did what they're expected to do, craft the type of entertaining story a buyer of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. would expect, but don't break anything while the regular writer is off. And looked at it from that perspective, I'm going to go ahead and give that a 4. So that leaves us with a 2, a 3, and 2 4s. I guess that would round to a 3.5, not bad. It didn't turn out to be an early preview of his Bronze Age work in the way I was expecting or almost hoping, but still interesting. With that, I am going to be wrapping up this first episode. Now, the second episode, I will be starting with my first coverage of Kirby in the Bronze Age, specifically Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 133, his first comic after returning to DC in 1970. I'll also talk a little about the move itself, why and how it occurred, and why he ended up on Jimmy Olsen of all books. So I want to thank you for joining me for this inaugural episode. As I said, I encourage feedback. You can leave a comment at thekirbycast.blogspot.com. There is also a Twitter account where you can contact me at thekirbycast. I know it's early also, but I'd appreciate any reviews on iTunes. They would help the show grow, so I'd be very thankful for that. And with that, I will see you next time to talk about Jimmy Olsen 133. A cold finger.